let me tell you where you are in case you're in the wrong place. You can go somewhere else. You're in the Senate Education and Workforce Committee. If you're on the wrong plane, get off now because we are headed in the right direction. And I'm Senator Vicki Walker. Please remember to turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate. And if you're new to the committee and want to testify, well, I would say sign up, but we don't really have any bills to sign up to testify on today. So that's sort of my standard lingo that comes out, and I wasn't realizing we didn't have any bills. We do have some bills we need to introduce, committee, and we need to get that done before 3:15 so we can get these printed tomorrow. You have them sitting at your station here, and they are LC 1292, and I'd like to introduce both of these as committee bills. LC 1292 allows school districts to offer half-day or full-day kindergarten, provides for apportionment from the state school fund for full-day kindergarten. And LC 985 directs the State Board of Education to enter order to remove large school districts from education service districts, directs the State Board to enter order to merge remaining areas of education service districts so that no more than 8 education service districts exist, prohibits education service districts from incurring bonded indebtedness, and provides that new education service districts become operative on July 1, 2007. Now, let me say, colleagues, as you know, because you serve in other committees, entering these as committee bills does not endorse or say that you are opposed or anyway does anything on these bills other than gets them in play. I'm particularly interested in getting this education service district bill introduced today as well as the other one because we start our discussion on ESDs next week. On the 7th, we'll have the governor's office come in and they'll give a presentation on what they've been doing with the ESDs to work up a proposal. There's no proposal on the table, so we're going to introduce something to get rolling. Then that will be followed by discussion on this bill. Then on Friday, we will not be meeting, by the way, next Wednesday.
The 9th.
2 weeks from now, I'm sorry. 2 weeks from now, on Wednesday the 9th, we'll be meeting Monday the 7th and Friday the 11th, but not on the 9th. Friday the 11th, we will be going into Senator Cruz's district for our out-of-district meeting in Douglas County. We'll be convening our hearing at the Douglas ESD office because we can patch in the South Coast and Medford ESDs. And we'll be doing that in the morning. We hope to have a lunch. We're working on that, getting a lunch with the Chamber of Commerce. Perhaps Senator Cruz might be able to help us with that. And in the afternoon, we're going to have a little field hearing on an education program they have going down there. So that is really where we're headed in the next 2 weeks. Did I forget anything else? Okay, so does anyone have any questions about that before I take a motion on the two bill drafts?
I did, Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, this screams work group. Interesting concept. I know people have been talking ESDs and consolidation, all that, for a long, long time. You know, there's a lot of players need to be involved in this, so it almost screams work group if you want to move forward with this. I just want to offer service.
I can't support this. Out and out, I will not support this. I am totally opposed to it. I like to have the work group before the bill is introduced. I also would like to have a copy of the bills that we're going to have as committee bills before we walk in the door. That would help. They have.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we delivered copies of these LC drafts to your office yesterday.
Okay.
All right.
I didn't see them.
Okay, well, members, our committee administrator is here to serve us as well as she can, and she's done a good job.
It's my fault for not having seen the bill. So I'll talk to my staff and beat them around the head and shoulders for not giving me the bill.
All right. Because I know that was done. So thank you for your apology. My hope is that we can enter this draft and begin the discussion. The governor's office has been working with ESD groups, and they are working on a proposal. We don't have one. We'd like to get this on the table so we can have a discussion. And this bill actually relates to education service districts, so this bill does not have to remain in its present form. In fact, it probably won't remain in its present form. So I would like to at least get this introduced as a committee bill.
Okay. As a courtesy, I will support it as a committee bill. As a courtesy, I will oppose it all the way.
All right.
Including the final draft, I will not pull it out of committee.
And Senator Morissette, I appreciate that, and I totally understand that, and you're free to do
well,
that.
Well, and I think it's...
Your courtesy would be appreciated
okay.
today.
Good. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I move that we submit as committee bills LC 985 and LC 1292.
Okay, thank you. Senator Starr moves that we submit LC 985 and LC 1292 as committee bills. Any objection? And I understand we have a courtesy vote from Senator Morissette. Any objection?
Madam Chair, no objections. Both of these are, I think, a long way from finished product, which is totally understandable. LC 985, I am personally very interested in work group product on that. So,
great. Thank you. All of your comments are appreciated, very much appreciated and duly noted. And if we hear no other objection, then so be it. Those will now become committee bills, and I need to sign those, and we need to get them off right away. And I thank the committee.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I'd like to make a comment about the kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
I had a bill at one time that would have lowered the age, mandatory attendance age, from 7 to 5. That would have required that everyone attend the half-day kindergarten, and that didn't go. I see non-attendance in an already available kindergarten as a hindrance to setting patterns and so on. I did that at the request of our local superintendent. I'm very interested in a half-day kindergarten. I don't know that we will ever go to a full-day kindergarten because of funding and also the curriculum, whether or not kids can stand a full day. So I will be also interested in the kindergarten issue, because that is something that I think we need to look at and encourage more people to take advantage of the half day that's offered.
Senator Starr, I know you're jumping at the bit here too. I think it's a good subject that we're going to be talking about.
I had an opportunity as a child to enter school as a 5-year-old. Because my birthday was on October 1st. My parents chose to hold me out until I was a 6-year-old so that I turned 7 soon after entering school. I think because of the family situation, that was a wise choice. I graduated as a 17-year-old, which is fairly unusual, but not strikingly so. I think that the children who most need preschool and kindergarten are the ones least likely to voluntarily show up, and I don't know what we do with that. But I think that requiring kindergarten for a child who is being properly trained at home is a waste of public funds. And so it's a tough thing for me to say that we should have kindergarten for all children.
Well, thank you, Senator Starr. I know that when we get to both of these subjects, we are going to have a very lively in-depth discussion. Senator Morissette.
If you're going to homeschool, you can homeschool kindergarten as well as first grade, so I don't see that it makes a difference for people who are going to homeschool. And the homeschoolers are the ones that killed it. They're the ones that killed the bill.
Okay.
And I didn't think it even applied to them.
All right. Well, we'll hold this discussion for another day, gentlemen.
Just one comment, Madam Chair. And when we're looking at going to full day K, at the same time we're proposing cuts to Head Start, that could be a problematic, too.
As I said, it will be a lively discussion, Senator. All right, colleagues, thank you for your indulgence for the work measures. Now we're going to move into our informational meeting. We have a pretty exciting agenda today. First up, we're going to hear from Karen Phillips, the director of Oregon Small Schools Initiative, and then we're going to hear from Lisa Miette and have other invited testimony about youth suicide prevention and school-based counseling, which has been an issue very dear to my heart for a number of years. So, colleagues, with that, Ms. Phillips, could you introduce yourself and state your name, please?
Certainly. Thank you, committee, to having me here this afternoon to speak with you about something that I'm very passionate about. I'm Karen Phillips, the director of the Oregon Small Schools Initiative, which is a project of E3 Employers for Education Excellence. E3 is a nonprofit organization that grew out of the Oregon Business Council, and their primary focus is to bring educators and employers together to improve schools so that all students achieve. What I'll do for you this afternoon is tell you about the Oregon Small Schools Initiative, what our goals are and our strategies, the schools that we're working with, our progress so far, and then as a summation and talking about that particular initiative, I do want to spend some time talking to you about how that ties in with the Oregon graduation requirements and where schools are on that process. So I believe you have a packet of information, and in that you'll be able to follow along with my presentation. The Small Schools Initiative is generously funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Oregon's own Meyer Memorial Trust, $25 million through 2009 to work with a select group of schools, high schools specifically, in Oregon. Our mission is to create high-achieving and equitable small high schools, and in a few minutes I'll talk to you about that smallness and exactly what we mean. And our purpose in doing so, I think, is probably your same purpose in looking at the number of bills, such as the ones you were just discussing, to close the achievement gap in Oregon between students of color and low-income students and their peers, to increase Oregon's graduation rate, and increase the number of students ready for post-secondary education. We know in the 21st century, when students leave high school and are going to go into training or into the workforce, that given the skills that are needed in any entry-level position that's going to be a family wage job, students need more skills than high school can afford, and we believe that high schools can do that for students. I want to share with you two model high schools that represent the research that our small school strategy is built on. One of them is the International High School in LaGuardia, New York. It's on the campus of LaGuardia Community College, and as you look at the graduation rate and the college acceptance rate of the students at LaGuardia, this is a small high school, about 450 students. But what I find most intriguing about this particular high school, when I look at the number of students that are succeeding, is that every student in this school has been in the United States 4 years or less. Wow. Every student, 4 years or less. And they are graduating 95%, and of that 95%, 94% are admitted to college or eligible to be admitted to college when they walk out the door.
Ms. Phillips, that's an astounding number. How many children are enrolled in this school?
450 in this particular school.
Wow. And the teacher ratio per student, teacher-student ratio?
I don't have that with me. I certainly could get that to you.
Okay.
Further in my presentation, I'm going to talk about what International High School and some other schools that the research is founded on has found that they do have common attributes. Being small is one of them, but being small in itself is not a magic bullet. If it was, we could turn to all the small schools we have in Oregon, and they should all be our highest achievers, and they are not. But there is, I think, something that small allows us to do. I want to share one other high school with you. It's Urban Academy, and it also happens to be in New York City. What's unique, two things unique about Urban Academy. Urban Academy is one of six small schools located in a facility that was a large traditional school. And that's part of what we're trying to create in the Oregon Small Schools Initiative. It's small, standalone schools, such as International High School, that's in its own building and has a little over 400 students, or taking our currently large high schools that exist and using the same facility, breaking them up into small high schools. Urban Academy is an example of that can also work and have incredible results, because in Urban Academy, they've had a number of graduating classes where 100% of the students graduated. And of those students, 97% were either admitted to college or eligible to be admitted to college. Urban Academy is a school with 70% minority enrollment and 75% low-income enrollment. And their size is about 180 students. So when I say research says, these are the examples in the last decade that are growing across the United States that show us what's possible with high school students.
Thank you, Ms. Phillips. Senator Morissette, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm more familiar with the, for instance, the language immersion school, which District 4J has had successfully for years. Where are the urban academies?
This statistics come from the Urban Academy, which is in Julia Richmond High School in New York City.
We don't have one in Oregon.
We don't have one yet in Oregon.
We have several that are trying to model.
Okay, that sounds really good. And I may I, Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr.
Morissette. I've often felt that districts, and particularly District 4J in Eugene, has done a marvelous job in doing a variety of alternative schools. And I raised that issue when the charter school thing came along. Why do we need charter schools when we can create these within the district, and 4J has? And I'm really interested in the development of this idea of an urban academy.
Yeah, and the Urban Academy, thank you for mentioning charter schools, is not a charter school. It's a public school, as you are saying. We could create them with or without the charter law.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Well, we'll stop. I'm trying to get my hands around this Urban Academy. The International High School, it almost sounds like a self-selected group. If they're all foreign nationals, that's probably, I mean, they're...
It's a focus of the school, yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a demographic there, but you're saying that the Urban Academy is a small school inside a big school. So I'm assuming that we have a big school that's been divided up into segments,
exactly.
And this is a targeted population inside of that bigger school population?
Yes, and I wouldn't say, in this case, I wouldn't say targeted in the way you mean it as international was, but within the... put it in Oregon's terms, within the attendance area of a particular high school, all of the students who would belong within the Julia Richmond, which is the large high school here, attendance area, attend one of the six schools within the complex. Urban Academy is one of those, and it has some themes or strategies that may look different than the school next door to it, and students choose. But regardless, they go to a public school and pick a choice within that setting.
So, follow up. So we have this, what used to be a big school that has been segmented out to where there's kind of an educational focus.
Exactly.
And so really we have what you're calling this small school model. There are six of them there, and this is one of those six.
Exactly.
Thank you.
And Ms. Phillips, you're going to be talking about what we have in Oregon, and I know we have one in my district at North Eugene High School,
yes,
which is a school within a school.
And also in Springfield and Hillsboro, I know is of interest to a couple of senators here.
We have one.
Great. All right. Well, we'll let her continue.
So it's very close to home, and I encourage you to visit the schools. The research on which this strategy is built, again, is about 10 years worth of looking at looking at small high schools and how do they compare to achievement, violence, graduation rates, etc., compared to small schools. And so what you see in front of you are some of the results when schools are smaller. And the research talks about somewhere between an enrollment of 300 and 800, the schools that we'll be creating in Oregon will be schools of 400 or less. And we chose that number because that tends to show more often in the research as being a size that creates the conditions in which you can take students to the type of achievement that I was just showing you. In particular, while we're at this particular slide, I want to point out that in smaller schools, achievement is certainly higher, as you can read, but also there's less violence there. And in Marshall High School, one of the 10 high schools in Portland School District, Marshall is one of the schools working with us, population of about 800 to 900 students, and this September, they opened their doors as four small schools within the facility that used to be Marshall High School.
Yeah.
They are already, just within 4 months, September through December, they are already seeing a difference in the incidence of violence and the incidence of vandalism.
Yes, Senator Morset.
You say that they're into their program this year. Last session, we had a report from the principals of Jefferson and Marshall to lay out that program. And now that they've had some experience, it would be interesting to look.
I would encourage you, Roosevelt, Jefferson, and Marshall are the three high school, the large high schools in Oregon who have taken this step already and taken it.
Well, that's something that at some point we might want to invite them back to give us an update on what they've done, because they had spent quite a bit of time talking about what they're going to do.
Thank you, Senator.
I share this slide. When Oregon Small Schools Initiative was first starting our project, we worked with a statistician to do a demographic study of the high school students of Oregon. We wanted to know who our high schools were, who are the students in there, and what's the demographics of the school, and what's their achievement. This is before we had worked with any of the schools. And because we knew we were going to be bringing in a small school strategy, we took a look at the high schools in Oregon that had rates of low-income students of 30% or greater, and that was measured by the number of students in the free and reduced lunch program. And we broke the high schools up into those in Oregon that were 800 or more students or 800 or less students. And we took a look at the student population's achievement rate, percentage of students who were proficient or exceeding proficiency on the Oregon State Assessment tests in writing, reading, math, and math problem solving, and created a school average out of that, an achievement average. And the green and red dots that you see on this graph represent a high school in Oregon that had a student population of low-income students 30% or greater. The green dots represent the high schools in Oregon that had a population less than 800. The red dots represent a high school in Oregon that had a population 800 or greater. And then, and as you can see, there are varying levels of achievement, which tells us that size alone is not going to determine whether you're high achievers or low achievers, because you've got red dots high on the graph and low dots on the graph. As you move across the horizontal axis, the number of students in low income or poverty gets greater, moving to the right. And as you move up the vertical axis, the percentage of students who are proficient on the Oregon State test gets greater. So we were trying to find a line of best fit, hence the green line and the red line. And there really is no line of best fit, as scattered as these dots are. But we found something interesting. Notice how steep going down the red line is as compared to the green. What this says, if you take schools with populations of low-income students, the students in the smaller school no other instructional strategies were looked at, et cetera, just by size alone, are achieving higher than the low-income representative school in the larger schools. So what we see in Oregon is something that we see national, and that smallness negates, it doesn't completely get rid of, but it negates the effects of poverty better than large. What that tells us in Oregon, if we have a number of students who have a significant population of low-income students, and we do have a number of those schools in Oregon, that being small could give that school and those students a better chance of being high achievers. Now, there's some other things that I think they need to do, but being small could make a big difference. And this is Oregon data, and it's matched by national data in looking at schools nationally, what difference does smallness make in terms of negating the effects of poverty, because poverty and low achievement are correlated. I'm not saying they're caused, but correlated. Nationally, there can be an effect of as much as 10 times. So purely by a student being in a large school as compared to a small school, the poverty could affect them 10 times as much in terms of their achievement, just by the sheer size of the school. But as I've been mentioning, small in itself is not enough. There are low-achieving small schools just as there are low-achieving large schools. What's important about the smallness is what it allows the program and the teachers and the parents to do. It creates a learning environment where teachers and parents together can focus on taking students to an agreed-upon higher standard, in other words, it's rigorous, and creating a learning environment for students that's more personalized to their interests, either career interest or personal interest, and therefore more relevant to the student. And we know as adult learners, if something's more relevant to me, it's more motivating to me. I learn more, and that's the same of students. We're also finding that smallness enables us to know each other. If we know each other and create meaningful relationships, we also learn more from someone who knows us and someone we've developed a relationship with. So what's one of the things that small does is to create the conditions for improved learning. But even that, those conditions are not enough. What a decade of research has told us, and this is what the Oregon Small Schools Initiative strategies are built upon, is that the high-achieving schools have more than just small. They have these seven attributes that you see in front of you. And that's true whether I'm an elementary school, a middle school, or a high school. The more of these seven attributes I have in place, the more likely it is that my students will be achieving at high levels. In your packet, you have, I believe yours is green, you have a definition of each of these seven. And I do need to point out just a couple of them. By common focus, this does not necessarily mean it's a theme-based school like a performing arts school. By common focus, it means that parents, students, and teachers together have come together and agreed upon what is the purpose of our school and what do we believe about teaching and learning and how students learn, and every decision we make will be tied to that, and we'll create a school with a focus, a philosophy, values about learning.
Thank you, Ms. Phillips. Senator Morissette, you have a question?
Yes. Well, the question is, what about parental involvement? And I think I know the answer, but that is the most important thing in a common focus. What about parental involvement in order to get into the school?
In order to get into the school?
Yeah, yes.
Help me with your question. Parental involvement is very important for students to succeed in these small schools. Work very closely with their parents, more than we would probably usually see at the high school level, more similar to what we see at the elementary level.
Is this a condition of admission to the school? It is not.
It is not.
Okay.
Just an outgrowth, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank
you.
Yeah.
I wanted to make sure I heard you correctly.
Okay. So
Senator Cruz, you have a question?
Yes.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at the attributes, and I think high expectations is probably what I would put on the top, because you expect more, you get more sort of thing, but and they all kind of flow together. But it has, when you say parental involvement is not a precursor requirement to come in, but it seems to be something that happens naturally once the children are in the setting?
It's, I would say, more than happens naturally. It's intentionally grown by the school and the program. So it's not a precursor if you don't have parent involvement, because many of these schools are public schools.
Right.
So they take the students, but then there is an intentional focus of the school program and personnel that we need to reach out to our parents and get them involved, not just depend on them to do that as some parents do naturally. But for those who don't, we bring them in and help them see how they can be involved.
Okay. Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
The point here, I mean, you know, the anecdotal stuff you hear is basically that schools and more affluent communities, you see a higher level of parental involvement, and in the poorer schools, you see less, and parents that don't care, blah, blah, blah. But if we're talking about schools with high levels of poverty, that goes totally contrary to that philosophy.
Right. What we're seeing in these model schools is that in poverty areas, low income areas, just because we don't immediately see high parental involvement does not mean they don't care and they won't. It means we need to try different strategies, and in doing that, there are model schools out there that are showing us parents are very willing to be involved, but maybe we have to do things differently. Maybe it's not superintendent coffee hour at 10 o'clock if I'm a low-income single parent who's working two jobs. Maybe I need to be meeting at a different place at a different time, et cetera. That's one example.
Thank you. Senator Morissette, did you have another question?
No.
Okay.
I think you've answered.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ms. Phillips. You want to continue?
I will be referring back to these attributes and teaching practices, because I think this is critical for the state of Oregon. If we're going to take our schools and our students to the next level, it's not that there isn't a foundation of knowledge to know what to do. We know what to do. The question is, how do we garner the commitment and the will in the public and our civic leaders and in our educators to move our schools forward. But I believe it's doable, and I have some stories about Oregon schools that are starting that. In working with Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and they have worked with the small school strategies in high schools across the United States, they do quite a bit of research. And in their latest research report that just came out this fall, looking at those seven attributes I was just sharing with you, what they found in the schools they were looking at, and these were all schools either small by size or one of those large schools like Urban Academy was in, it was large and they broke up into small. What they found was the more of those seven attributes that a school had in place, the more likely it was the teachers were putting into place what they called reform-like teaching, or teaching strategies such as project-based learning, mentors and internships where students are working with adults in the community, multidisciplinary instruction where I'm a social science teacher, maybe teaching history, a time period of history, along with a language arts teacher that has students writing and reading about the same period of time. The more the seven attributes in place, the more teachers were likely to use good instructional strategies, the more of those strategies that were in place, the more they began to see a change in student attitudes. And in particular, the three student attitudes that were changing the fastest, sometimes within 1 year of beginning to put these strategies in place, were that students were more interested in the work they were doing at school. Students were more persistent if they saw the work as hard, challenging, or maybe even not so interesting to them. They were more willing to stick with it. And students were beginning to have a stronger academic self-concept. Do I believe I can do this mathematics? Do I believe that I can be in an AP advanced placement class and succeed? I find that really exciting research that tells us there's something to those seven attributes if by putting them in place
Within 1 year, we begin to see changes in student attitudes, and our hypothesis in the study from Gates as early is that with these change in attitudes will come the change in achievement, which usually takes 3 to 4 years when you put in a new program. The small school models that we've seen across the nation and that will be growing through the Small Schools Initiative are not a specific model where we come in and tell a school exactly what you need to look like, what your curriculum needs to be, et cetera. It's based on those seven attributes, and then these nine schools are currently existing schools across the nation, and they each look a little bit different. For instance, a thematic school, Boston Arts Academy, is a public school in Boston, a school of choice, and it's for students who are interested in one of the performing arts. Now, they learn all the other subjects, language arts, social studies, science, math, etc., but they're interested in one of the performing arts, and so teachers use that interest and tie it into the mathematics. Music and math go together very well. They tie it into the study of history or social science because certainly the arts change along with history. A student-centered school, for instance, as the Avalon in Minneapolis, Minnesota, is a school that's built its curriculum, what they teach, around student interests. So no courses. I don't go to math at 9:30 and science at 10:30, but all learning is created from student-generated projects, and they work with a teacher advisor who helps them look at the project, what are you interested in doing and working in the community, and then I'll help you find the learning in it. Are you learning to write? Are you learning history? What mathematics are you practice? And the projects are carefully chosen but by the students proposing them until they have learned and covered the state standards, because Minnesota has state standards just like we do. So in showing you those nine examples, I just want you to know that it's not about a certain type of school. It's about the attributes, and you could create any one of these schools, and they all have achievement very similar to that international school in Urban Academy.
Yes, Senator Morsett?
Thank you. Very quickly, what do you call the teacher? You said something else. We used to call them facilitators. We consider
teacher advisor.
Okay, you said advisor, but I think
facilitator may be similar. Teacher coach.
Well, I mean, I think a teacher is a facilitator of learning. A teacher isn't there to cram facts down to help people learn. And I think it's good that you use the right definitions or terms. I mean,
we're talking about
the advisor is a good term to use. I mean, it gives the connotation that the teacher is there to help the student.
Yes, it's not about, as you said, cramming the facts down you.
Yeah, it's a facilitation advisor role. Very good.
Exactly.
Senator Smith.
I see an international school showing up again here. Is that the same school?
Yes, it is.
So the international school
is
all these
a student-centered school.
Student-centered.
Where they grow the projects and the curriculum that the students work on through what the student is interested in. Exactly. It is the same school.
Thank you.
In the Oregon Small Schools Initiative, so that kind of gives you a background of the research that we're resting our strategies on, what we'll be doing in the state of Oregon through 2009 is three major focuses. One is to reconfigure 12 existing large high schools into these multiple schools, as I was sharing an example with you. Marshall High School, for instance, is one of those 12 that will be working with us. We have selected 8 so far and are in a process of selecting the other 4. So ultimately we'll have 12 currently large high schools in Oregon that are interested and willing into breaking down into multiple small high schools. In the brochure that you have and in the inside pocket, you have the names and a description of the current 8 schools that are working with us and are in the process of breaking down into multiple small schools. As I mentioned, we do have a school in Hillsboro, and that's Liberty High School, who currently is in their second year as a school, and they are in 4 academies. Those academies are not separate schools yet. They still share some students. A student might go from one of the academies to another to take a music class or an arts class, whereas at Marshall High School, their four schools are literally separate schools. I spend all day with these teachers in this part of the building. So there's a little bit of difference in how far they've gone in creating their schools, but Liberty's on their way to being four autonomous schools.
May I one more time?
Yes, Senator Morissette.
One more time. I had a conversation with our school district in Springfield, and I knew that there was something going on with this program, but they haven't selected. Have they selected the school yet?
Springfield, as a matter of fact, is my next bullet. Thank you for that segue. We will also be working with 12 new schools, schools that aren't created yet, and they will be public magnet schools or charter schools. Springfield is one of those schools. We've selected four so far, and we have another eight to select. Springfield is one of those. They are creating a district magnet arts school. They're working with us. Eagle Point is also creating a district arts school.
That's at Thurston?
No, it will probably be in a facility outside of the school district is what they're currently thinking. They're working with the arts community to see if they can get it closer to downtown.
Good. Great. Thank you very much.
So ultimately, by September of this year, we will have 24 schools in Oregon working with us and putting these attributes in place and working toward this high achievement that we believe is possible with these high schools. Additionally, part of our role, and that's one of the reasons I'm loved coming here today, is to be a catalyst to change teaching and learning in Oregon. So not just in these 24 schools, which we think will be models for other schools to go look at, right here in our own state, but also to share what we're learning with others within the state of Oregon. And we partner with a number of organizations to help us get that information out. We work with the Department of Education, Oregon School Boards Association, et cetera. For the schools to work with us for conversions, the large high schools had to be in Oregon. They had to be 700 enrollment or greater. And for a new school, it had to be a design that was planning on less than 400 students. In either case, because we are committed to closing the achievement gap, we are targeting populations that have a significant number of low-income and minority students because we want to help those students and those schools. School districts close the gap quickly. As we select schools, we do look for schools that are ready to embrace change because teaching in this fashion is different than in the traditional high schools that we currently see, and that they have a commitment to the small school strategy. To give you an overview of where we are currently, we've selected half our schools, and you can see that in terms of a north and south representation across the state, we have a pretty nice spread, but in moving east and west across Oregon, we don't have as good of a spread. And part of that is because in choosing our conversion schools, our large schools, there aren't large schools east of Bend. It's not with minority or low-income populations. I do want to point out, since that's the only school we're currently working with in Eastern Oregon, that in Pendleton, we're working with a charter school, Nakiawi Community School, which is on the Confederated Tribes Umatilla Reservation outside of Pendleton. What we provide for the schools, in addition to funding, and just to give you a ratio just to see how we're helping those. With the eight conversion schools we're working with, over the four-year total, depending on the size of the school, they get anywhere from about $700,000 to my largest school get almost $1.5 million to help them implement these changes that we're talking about.
Madam Chair,
Yes, Senator Morissette?
I would recommend looking at the Ontario School District. I did visit a charter school in Ontario. I think it's the Four Rivers School, and I think it would fit a lot of the criteria. That would be an Eastern Oregon school,
yeah.
And you are working with charter schools.
Right.
That's a relatively new one, and I was really impressed with what they're doing. It's a language immersion for English and Spanish for
Great.
The kids who are there, and involves migrant workers and low-income and all.
Do you know if that's a high school or an elementary school?
No, it's not a high school. I'm sorry. You need a high school?
These are just high schools.
Okay.
But
sorry.
But I'm always interested in hearing about schools that are succeeding.
Well, you might check Ontario.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you for the recommendation. In addition to the funding, what we offer the schools is technical assistance. We bring school staff and their administrators, sometimes parents and students, board members, superintendents together at workshops for trainings and for learning from each other. And what's somewhat unique about this particular program is that I also provide a coach, an expert in school change and in high school, a coach that works with the school and the leadership team and the principal through the 4 years of the grant. So each school that works with us will work with us over 4 years from the time they're selected, and they will have the same coach who is on campus about once a week, working with the schools, helping them make decisions, bringing resources into the schools. Primarily, the dollars that the schools are using are for research, for professional development and learning the new strategies so that I can teach all students well, and for changes in curriculum development to put new programs in place that are relevant and interesting to students. Two examples, as I've mentioned, Marshall High School is one of our schools. They have four small schools in place. Their schools happen to be theme-based schools. They have a BizTech Academy, Linus Pauling, which, if you don't recognize the name Linus Pauling, that's a science-focused school. Mm-hmm. Portland Academy of International Studies, which really looks at the cultures of different peoples and ethnicities and how they interrelate, and then the Renaissance Arts is a performing arts school. Liberty High School also has four academies. They happen to be theme-based, although, again, if you remember that model slide I show you, they don't need to be. And they chose their four schools, really looking at the six strands of the Oregon CAM. And you'll recognize these because we have a business CAM and a health and human services CAM, et cetera. And so that's where they have their interest. The challenges in working with schools, and these are schools who voluntarily came forward, who want to do this work. And the timing was wonderful in the metro section of the Oregonian today. This was one of the headlines. Advanced classes are a hard sell in Oregon, and we're finding that true. And I think Betsy Hammond, who wrote that story, very well summed that up, that there are challenges. One of them is believing who should be taking advanced placement classes and who can take them. Mm-hmm. Another is, as Betsy said in the article, advanced placement, whether they're a specific AP class or just a very rigorous class, are a lot of work for teachers. And as class sizes climb, the willingness of teachers to take on a class where I grade more papers or have to prepare more than I did before is currently a challenge that's out there. People are weighing whether I'm willing to commit to what I need to do. The other two biggest challenges that we're facing, and these are in communities and schools who have said, yes, I want to do something different, I want to be better. We're still getting, and this is where I think you can help us, we're still getting pushback from some people don't believe that all students can achieve at a high level. They don't believe it's possible, so they automatically write off some students. And some people don't believe that all students should or need to achieve at high levels. The first point, I would argue that I can take them to schools across the United States that are having all students achieve, whether I'm from a low-income family, a single-parent family, a minority student, whatever you think, a special education student, whatever you think my handicap is, I can show you schools that are achieving with every student. And the second one, I think for Oregon, economically and morally, we need every child to achieve at high levels, because in the 21st century, they all need high-level reading, writing, and mathematics skills, not just students that intend to go to a four-year college. What we found, not only in parents and teachers that we're talking with these beliefs, but just to bring you some statistics from two different studies that are very recent in Oregonians. One of them was the first one commissioned by the Chalkboard Project, and in asking Oregonians last April, so April 2004, what they thought the most important priority in education in Oregon was. 42% of Oregonians said getting kids ready to go to college, and 33% said ready to enter the workforce. Now, right now, those two factions believe they're saying two different things, and that makes it difficult for schools to build one program to move all students to high achievement. I would argue that the skills, and I think our employers would tell you the same thing, the skills we need for young adults entering the workforce and entering college in the 21st century are the same skills. In fact, the Education Trust, in their report, Thinking K-16, has a number of statistics. They've asked colleges and employers, and they're getting the same answers. It's the same skills. It's not 20 years ago when we had a vocational track and a college track. It's got to be a school with high standards for all students. Which leads to the second set of data. This was commissioned by Employers for Educational Excellence, again, about the same time, May of last year. And they asked Oregonians, do you think the current standards in K-12 education are set just right, too high, or too low? 5% said too high. 48% said about right. So there's about half. And 41% too low. Again, we've got a split, which is going to make our work difficult in moving education decisions forward, unless I think organizations like E3 and civic leaders like yourself help get the word out to Oregonians of what skills students need and that all students can achieve, and we can do this in Oregon.
That's
Senator Spray, you have a question?
Madam Chair, it popped right up top of the list. 22 credits. We're bottom nationally in graduation requirements. It's way too low.
Thank you, Senator. I don't even have to say that now. We are too low. Again, if we're going to educate all our students so they have the skills to be successful, both because it's the moral thing to do, but also for economically for Oregon, if we have high-level workers, they have high-level jobs with family wage salaries, they're paying taxes, you know the circle and how that works. It's in everyone's best interest. 22 credits, as they currently stand, and you do have Oregon current 22 credits. I don't remember what color that is in your packet, but I did bring a copy of the current graduation requirements for you. Those do not match with the skills that employers are asking for or college admission. So our minimum curriculum that we're allowing our students to graduate with is not it's not the high default that it should be, and half of the Oregonians, 41%, are agreeing with us already. We need to get the other half, seeing that this is in their best interest also.
Can I interrupt here? I think that's a really important point. Senator Starr has raised it before, and maybe the senator has an answer for me. Have we at any time had more credits than this required, and we dropped the number required, or have we just never excelled beyond 22?
I don't know when that was set.
We have not had higher and ever. We did 10, may have been more like 15 years ago, recently raised it to 22. So it used to be 19.
Oh.
And then we added a math credit. So it used to be lower. But if you look back 20 years and the skills that were needed in the workforce, the technology we didn't have 20 years ago was probably appropriate. So we've added a math credit since then, but and I'm trying to remember if the other credit was language arts or not as we move to 22, but we have not changed it recently.
I have a question, and Senator Morsett has another one. Where are we nationally in terms of the states?
And the number of credits were low to mid.
Okay. And New York, where you have those two exemplary schools?
I don't have that answer for you at this time.
Okay.
That's a great question, as a matter of fact.
Okay. Senator Morsett?
I can't, if I could just follow up. New York does have a graduation exam now. They've always had the Regents exam, but now they have an exam that all students need to take in order to graduate, and it's it would be similar to Oregon's assessment, but they've made it a requirement of graduation. In fact, 26 of the 50 states have done that in some type of a timeline, saying at this state students will need to meet this standard. So some are raising credits and doing an exit exam. Some are doing just one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think language. I'm sorry, foreign language. I think we dropped some of that. We may have added a foreign language. Well, I started teaching in high school in 1962, and I taught for 30 years, and I saw the curriculum change significantly with different subject areas, but I didn't see it expanding. And there, it's not easy to add more curriculum to high school. I mean, it may sound, you know, we need it, but it's not an easy thing to do.
Right. It
could require flexible scheduling and all kinds of things that people don't want to get into.
Well, I think we need to be careful of thinking of this in terms of adding things onto the current system. We currently have 22 credits. Many students take more of that, and that's great. But within the 22 credits, what's required? Because there are 8 electives as you look at the diploma requirements. Yeah. So it's not necessarily about adding more staff, depending on how we roll out what the expectations are. And then Oregon also has a regulation just passed a year and a half ago, credit for proficiency, which says students don't necessarily have to sit in a 130-hour class with a teacher in front of the classroom in order to get credit for what they're learning. So I would agree with the Senator. There are other ways of looking at how we build the skills in our students.
And Senator Starr, you have a question?
Well, I comment. Yes. Many of our high schools in the state have set a higher standard for graduation
yes.
from their own high school than the 22 credits.
That is correct.
And as I look at this and the complaints that I see from employers and from admissions offices, I think that we should demand or should have at least 3 but it's in math and 3 in science and 4 in language arts.
Yes.
As a minimum. And we don't.
I would agree. In fact, and I would be happy to send this link to you, I'll reference it again, the Education Trust, a national organization that does a lot of research. Again, they have a report, Thinking K-16, that speaks to what are the different graduation standards in different states and how do they relate to high skills either that professors want or what you were just describing. If students had 4 years of language arts, 3 of science, math, and social science, then they're meeting the college admittance expectations. They don't have to go. Everyone doesn't need to go to 4-year college if that's not what they need. But at least they could walk out the door with equity in knowing that I could. So I would agree, and so does this particular study through Education Trust, that the default curriculum should allow the door to be open for every child to go on to post-high school training. And those credits could be one way of defining that. We have found, again, through research, that for students who complete a second year of algebra, that they double the probability that they will complete a 4-year bachelor's degree.
Hmm.
Now that's if you were a betting person, those are nice odds.
Nice.
So your 3 years of math is something to think about. There are a number of schools in Oregon and in the nation that have said we do need a higher standard and every student who starts high school should start in algebra. And Marshall High School and Roosevelt and Jefferson are 3 of those schools. They no longer offer remedial courses. That doesn't mean that they say to students, if you don't have algebra skills, too bad, that's all we're offering. What they have done is every student starts in algebra so they can get through the second year of algebra, and then they have other ways to build their skills. So if they need extra time in math, they have after-school tutor, they have summer session, they have double math periods during the day. There are ways that schools are getting this done, and there are schools in Oregon doing that right now.
Thank you. Colleagues, we have about six more minutes on this subject, and then we're going to need to move on to our other presenters. So, Ms. Phillips, if you could wrap it up for us.
Thank you. In addition to the 22 credits in Oregon graduation requirements, new graduation requirements that affect the students who graduate in the class of 2007 are an education plan and profile, extended application, or many of us might know that as a senior project, although it doesn't have to be a senior project. Career-related knowledge and skills, which are skills such as problem solving, teamwork, communication, all the skills you'd want for an employee working for you, and then to have some career-related learning experiences that get high school students in the community. I know that right now the Department of Education and the Board of Education is getting some pushback from school districts across Oregon that in implementing these last four pieces, they're saying we can't do that. I would just like to enter two pleas to this group to work with me in that. Number one, I think they can do it, and there are schools right here in Oregon that have already implemented these, and we can turn to them. We don't have to start at ground zero. And that these components match perfectly with those attributes that I was just talking about that the research says is how we get to high achievement for all the kids. So I would just say to you and also to the Board of Education, this is not the time for us to back away from the good foundation that the Department of Education has already laid, how they came up with those four things, and again it references on the page you have for the diploma requirements, is these six components that come directly from the research that I'm talking about. So Oregon is in a good place with a good foundation. Now what we need to do is move forward and implement the plan we already have. I hope that the Small Schools Initiative with our 24 schools can show other schools with our help that this is doable and give them some models to look at. I want to thank you for your wonderful questions and for the amount of time that you allowed me to spend with you today. Appreciate that.
Ms. Phillips, I have a question, and I might have been distracted when you first started speaking. But in these small schools, for instance, at North Eugene High School, they have the regular high school, and then they have the small high school. And I think North Eugene may have started an international high school this year also.
Yes, they did.
So does a student make application to get into the small school, and then there's an enrollment cap, and it's first come, first serve? What is the application?
Currently at North Eugene, in the one school that you're talking about, it is an application school, and it does have a cap on it. What we're talking about in North Eugene is one of the schools working with us is having multiple small schools, and they may keep that one or not. It's their choice. And in the multiple small schools, a student chooses which one is most interesting to me.
I see.
And then students get in those. Marshall, for instance, did use a cap in each of the four type of schools, so some students got their second choice. Liberty did not put a cap, and so they have four small schools but of varying sizes.
Okay, great. Colleagues, Senator Cruz?
You know, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, you're still looking for pilots in this thing, and I might suggest that you might want to go to some of the more rural parts of the state where we have entire school districts that are struggling, decrease in attendance, high unemployment, and where you have like an entire school or high school that has maybe 300-400 students sort of thing. And there's a lot, especially in southern part of the state, that would fit that criteria. And I think it might be a good measure because our small schools are, I mean, we've got entire districts now that are looking at becoming charter as simply a way to survive sort
exactly.
of thing. So.
Exactly, and I appreciate that recommendation. The 12 small schools that we're looking to work with are schools that aren't created yet. It's actually creating new schools, but we hope to share the information we gain with currently existing schools. So I appreciate what you're saying, and we are interested in looking at other parts of Oregon, because as you've described, Oregon is very diverse in terms of what we look like in our population.
And just to follow up, I mean, if you're talking about schools that haven't been created yet, we have school districts that are on the verge of
yes.
ceasing to exist, so recreation
might be something they would be interested in.
Yeah, such as Paisley, for instance.
Yeah.
We'll try that. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Phillips. Your presentation has just been wonderful today. I think we've all learned a lot, and we hope to hear more about your progress in the future.
Thank you, and feel free to contact me if you have other questions.
You're welcome. Okay, so we will allow Ms. Phillips to disengage from her technology over there. Okay. Okay, so who do we want to start with? We'll just stand at ease here for a moment, committee, and take a water break or something. And we have most of our committee present. We'll have Senator Cruz join us shortly. And at the dais is Lisa Miette, and she's going to introduce herself and state her position and all those wonderful things. And I've known Ms. Miette for a long period of time. She serves the state of Oregon very well in her capacity as injury prevention manager. So take it away, Ms. Miette.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Walker and members of the committee. Take my badge off so it doesn't clank around. I manage the Injury Prevention and Violence Prevention Program at DHS, and I oversee Oregon's Youth Suicide Prevention Program as part of that responsibility. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I also want to tell you that for your convenience, there's a packet of handouts, and the slides that I'm going to go through are included in there, so you can find those now. I also want to say from the outset that there are many, many people from lots of disciplines that have been working in suicide prevention for years and years and years. And our office's work in suicide prevention is fairly new. We have entered this with lots of enthusiasm, and we've made lots of friends and have lots of partners across the state that we didn't have 5-7 years ago. And it's been a piece of work that I'm grateful to work at. And I want to thank everyone in the state that's been working on suicide on behalf of our program, the hard work they do. And those people are mothers and fathers, their brothers and sisters, their educators, their mental health practitioners, their public health workers, their health care providers, and their policymakers. Suicide prevention is something that everyone can get involved in some way, and so that's what I'm going to talk about a little bit today, but I'm going to talk most about how suicide prevention work that we're doing in the schools with partners across the state. So during this presentation, I'll talk about basically three or four things. One is I'll do a little piece on the magnitude and scope of the problem in the state. I'll talk about school-based efforts with a focus on safe teen. As part of this presentation, I'll show you a 2.5-minute segment of a film that was produced here in Oregon by the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention Northwest members. And that film is used in parts of the Safe Teen curriculum, and it's also used in other prevention practices around the state, so I thought you'd find it really interesting. And I'll also review briefly some of the resources that we have in the state. To start out with the data part of the presentation, Oregon's death rate for youth due to suicide has been higher than the nation for over a decade. With one exception, in 2001, Oregon's rate dipped below what the national rate is to a low of 6.6 per 100,000. And unfortunately, that death rate has risen in 2002 and also in 2003. We have the data in for 2003, but we can't compare it to the national because the national data for 2003 isn't in yet. Suicide deaths among youth in the state between 1999 and 2003, there are striking gender differences. Death rates for males are 3 to 5 times higher than they are for females. The rates are highest among 20 to 24-year-olds. There's a rate of 27 per 100,000 in that age group. I've changed this slide a little bit from the one in your handout, and the reason I did that, in 2001 we evaluated the adolescent suicide attempt data system. And we found that attempts are underreported by hospitals by as much as 50%. So when we talk about suicide attempts in presentations, we generally double the number of attempts. And so this slide shows an N of about 1,800. And female attempts, you'll notice, outnumber males by about 3 to 5 times. So it's exact opposite for attempts as it is for deaths. Psychological conditions are something that we collect data on in the Suicide Attempt Data Registry for youth in the state. And one thing I should say about the Suicide Attempt Data System is we're the only state in the United States that has such a system, and it provides us with an enormous piece of data in terms of being able to fashion preventive measures. And I'll give you an example of that. We know that 48% of the youth who were treated for a suicide attempt were found to have a mood disorder of some sort. Those disorders were depression, bipolar disorder, and dysthymia. And that many, many youth report a variety of psychological problems. We also know that the number of risk factors increase in a youth's life, the likelihood of their admission in hospitals really increases, and the likelihood of repeat attempts also increases. Mm-hmm. As many as 42% of youth that come in for a suicide attempt are treated report a previous attempt to the one they're being treated for.
Can you hold that thought, Senator Cruz?
Do you have statistics that tie that to drug use, either with the kids or with or family drug patterns? I would assume that there is a fairly high connection.
Yeah, Chair Walker, Senator Cruz. One of the things that we get from the data set is an indication if they had drugs or alcohol on them or had taken them when they came, and it's just a suspicion because they don't run a blood test on everybody that comes through. So our data aren't as good on that, but we think as many as 25% have been using when they attempt.
Follow up. I would, you know, especially if you're getting into depression, you can get into some cultural things and family drug history and things like that. I think would probably be relatively prevalent in there. That's
Senator Walker, Senator Cruz. I would definitely agree with that. And one of the things that we know from the precipitating conditions that we collect data on is that the youth report, 7% of them report family discord, 31% report school-related problems in their life, 20% report an argument with their boyfriend or girlfriend precipitating the suicide attempt, 17% report substance abuse as a problem. Rape and sexual abuse is present in 11% of the youth that are treated for attempts. Peer pressure or conflict among peers is reported in 8%. A move to a new school is in 5%. Physical abuse reported in 5%. So one of the things that we think about, and there are numbers of more precipitating factors, there's a longer list, but the thing to think about is when you're working with youth, the number of risk factors that they have really increases the problem, the potential for them having suicidal behavior or psychological problems associated.
Senator Morset?
Yesterday we met with the president of the University of Oregon to talk about, we talked about many things, but we also have a bill that would address the university's struggle with suicide and an enforced furlough. And the purpose of our bill is to make sure that there is due process used both in requiring someone to take something and a furlough. Now, my question is, are you dealing with the universities with this issue, because that's something that scares them significantly? And they just got through drafting rules, which they haven't quite gotten to us yet, but we're... So what's your...
Chairman Walker, Senator Morset, we've worked with people from University of Oregon setting up their suicide prevention activities. We've been doing some training, mostly around awareness and education. We produced a public presentation, and we had, I'm trying to remember, how many colleges? 7 or 8 colleges from around the state phone in and participate in that training. So we're beginning work with colleges and universities. In fact, we're really interested in expanding that work. We're working with Dr. Kirk Wolf, who's a child psychiatrist, to develop a brochure for college-age kids and their parents to help them understand the problem and risks around suicide and psychological conditions like mood disorders that contribute to suicidal behavior. We expect that brochure to be ready early spring this year, and we want to get that out to the colleges. Another effort that we know is coming is money from the Garrett Lee Smith Memorial Act is going to be coming to the state, and 5% of the funds from that act will be going to colleges and universities in the state.
We need to talk. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. An important thing to know if you're going to try to prevent suicide among youth is who you have told prior to an attempt. And one piece of data that we collect from our data system is who they told. And you can see in this slide that about 85% of youth tell either a parent, friend, or sibling of an attempt before they make that attempt. This doesn't mean that teachers or counselors can't intervene. It indicates that we need to assist teens and parents and siblings in connecting with teachers and counselors and people that can help them. 4 out of 10 kids tell someone. Oregon's Healthy Teen Survey collects data on youth suicide risk behavior, including symptoms of mood disorders, suicide thought, and attempts. In eighth graders in Oregon in 2003, 19% of girls and 9% of boys reported that they seriously considered suicide in the past year. Among 11th graders, that was 16% of girls and 9% of boys. We have some special efforts going on in Oregon, and one of them is our adolescent suicide attempt data system. We're asked to talk nationally a lot about this data system. Many states are looking at implementing them. Oregon legislature established this data system in 1997. In 1998, we began collecting data, so we have data historically back that many years. It's really helpful to us in planning. The governor's task force on for the suicide prevention was formed in the mid-90s, and it issued a report with recommendations. And one of the recommendations out of that report was we establish a suicide prevention coordinator in health services. And one of the directions from that legislation was that we establish a state plan for suicide prevention, and that plan was published in December 2000. And it served really as a roadmap for communities that are looking at things that they can do to implement suicide prevention strategies in their communities. When we wrote it, we knew that there wasn't going to be significant state funding to help local folks implement suicide prevention. So we thought very carefully with about 1,500 people from all across Oregon, how among agencies and non-governmental organizations that are responsible for the health and safety of children, they could, within their existing work, implement suicide prevention. So the plan talks a lot about that. We're getting ready to...
Colleagues, I brought a copy of the plan down, and I'll pass it around as we listen to Ms. Nieto's presentation.
Thank you very much. The plan now is 5 years old, and we're getting ready to revise or update the plan. We're going to have a meeting in Portland on February the 18th, and we're inviting lots of people to come and contribute in person that day. We don't mean to rewrite the plan completely, because lots of people use that plan and refer to the 15 strategies included in it in their work for grants, in their work for building their programs. So if we change it, we'll probably add strategies to it and of course, update the data that's in it and the people that have participated in the planning effort. And we're quite proud of the partnership that we created to build the plan. We included members from state agencies, including OMAS and OYA and CAF, from the health department, from the adolescent health and maternal child health, we went outside of state government to local government and included people in county mental health and county public health, agencies that serve youth like Looking Glass and Eugene. Josephine County Mental Health was involved. Some universities were involved. So we also geographically got a good representation of people from across the state to participate. And we did 13 community forums around the state when we decided on a number of strategies we wanted to include. And I believe, Chair Walker, you were involved in one of those meetings.
I did. I coordinated the forum in Lane County, and we had that down in Cottage Grove.
Yeah. So we don't want to disenfranchise anybody that was involved in putting this together, but we're going to try to bring new blood into the work, and that's really helpful where we're at right now. So we also have a state agency team for this prevention of youth suicide that includes representatives from all the agencies I named earlier. We meet about quarterly, and the purpose of that group is to coordinate among the agencies so that we're all talking about the same things and pushing the heavy ball up the hill in the same direction. And we're working with lots of state agencies, non-governmental organizations, and local groups to implement strategies in that plan. And so implementation of the plan is really a work in progress. You have a copy of the exec summary for that plan in your packet. And in the plan, we encourage communities to adopt a multifaceted approach because experts in suicide prevention across the nation agree that no one silver bullet is going to do it in suicide prevention. We'll have to have many disciplines involved doing many different types of work on different levels, on the individual level, family level, community level, institution level, and government level. So let's talk a little bit about school-based efforts. That's what I came here to talk about primarily. Safe Teen is a school-based effort that we worked with in the state. There were 10 school districts that we trained in Safe Teen back in 2003. WeCare is a new effort. WeCare has been in place in middle school in Multnomah County for over 10 years. And we've taken this model that they created in Multnomah County, and we're going to develop it for statewide dissemination. And the beauty of that is it'll be a homegrown model that we can give to people. They won't have to buy it, and we can do the training. Also in the state, mostly in Deschutes County, but also in Jefferson, Grant, and John Day counties, the Jason Foundation curriculum on suicide prevention is in place. There's another curriculum called Red Flags that's in place in some schools in Deschutes, Jefferson, Grant, and Crook. There are school-based health centers that are working on suicide prevention, and a project called Reconnecting Youth in Lane County, Multnomah County, and Benton counties. It's a skill-building program for kids that are at high risk for many, many things, and suicide is just one of them. Finally, there's a new program called Connecting Youth. We're doing a pilot project with Deschutes County and Benton County to actually do an intervention with the parents and the youth after they've made an attempt and be treated in an emergency room. It's a skill-building project for the parents to help them see their successes and what they can do to help their child, and it's an ongoing assessment period for the youth that's involved in the project. So we'll actually begin implementation of that. We're in a training and contract building phase right now. Implementation will probably start late March and early April. Why Safe Teen? Safe Teen is based on best practice research. It's multifaceted. It provides outreach to those at risk. It educates school staff, parents, peers, siblings to recognize warning signs in teens. It teaches people to recognize a crisis and respond effectively. It teaches how to offer support to youth who are suicidal and to survivors of suicide attempts and suicides. And it raises awareness of suicide prevention in the community. The history of this project is a really beautiful tale of collaboration between OMAS and the health division and
OMAS is?
Oh, excuse me. Chair Walker.
I actually don't even know what
I'm
it is.
I'm going to have to pay money for that now back at my office.
Well, this committee has not instituted that yet, but we may if
I
this
think,
keeps
I
up.
Think, yeah.
The Office of Mental Health and Substance Abuse and Addictions.
Thank you.
And at that time, they were the Mental Health Office and the Office of Substance Abuse. So they were involved in AFSP Northwest, which is the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention Northwest. We worked together to pool resources. Everybody had a little bit of money left over from grants, and we wanted to bring this trainer out from Colorado to train these school districts. And 4 days before the training, we all agreed to do this. We got the training set up. We had 30 people coming on Monday. And 4 days before the training, the state decided that we couldn't provide any statewide trainings anymore. So we called Northwest Health Foundation and said, 30 people are coming. The trainer's already flying here from Colorado. and we need $20,000. And they stepped into the breach and provided some funding, so we had another agency on board, and so we got our first pilot project started in that way. So it's just kind of a beautiful tale that I love to tell, because everybody had their oar in the water on that. So we implemented the training, and initially it went into schools in Clackamas County, Douglas, Lane, Tillamook, Multnomah, Hood River, as well as in a couple of agencies. We trained staff from Morrison Center, and we trained people from state agencies to act as part of a technical assistance team for the state. Safe Teen at a glance. What schools have to do to implement it is they have to develop support from their superintendent and principal. And sometimes there are barriers to that. They have to develop, as once they get that support, they have to develop written policies and procedures about suicide prevention, what's going to be done in a crisis situation, how we're going to follow up with postvention, what we're going to say to the media, what we're going to tell other kids when we have a crisis. There are lots of things that people are certainly a little bit frightened about when it comes to talking about suicides to other children and among the staff. And part of the policy and procedures and the training for the staff clear away those fears and a lot of those barriers to doing good work with everyone. They also encourage schools who are fairly insular sometimes to develop partnerships with community mental health providers, the hospital, EMS, and the community crisis responders outside of the school. They train every member of the school staff in awareness and how to recognize a crisis and how to respond appropriately. They educate parents to take any talk of suicide seriously and how to respond. And finally, they train students. And that has been, in the past, fairly controversial. Students are perceived to be not able to deal with the topic of suicide. Some people are frightened that if we talk to students about suicides that they'll get the idea in their head and they'll do it. The reverse is really true. If we give students the opportunity to learn about suicide and mental health conditions, then they can share appropriately and ask for help that they need. So one of the...
Yes. Yes, Senator Morrison.
Thank you. Are you aware of the Safe School Hotline that was set up through the AG's office to deal? Okay. I hope that's part of the prevention strategy, with having students call that hotline if somebody is good. I'm glad you're aware of that.
Chair Walker, Senator Morsett, yes, that hotline is available to the kids, as well as the 1-800 suicide line, and as well as the local county community crisis response numbers.
Good. Thank you.
So, yeah. Finally, one of the things I wanted to give you a chance to do is look at that 2.5-minute clip of the film. Is that...
Madam Chair, before we do that, when you say train all students, so basically a school is committing to making this part of curriculum.
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, that's correct.
Okay.
And it's as many as 3 sessions over a school year.
Okay, which I think is totally appropriate. I think kids could probably divert kids better than anybody else could in a lot of these cases, because they speak the same language, and that's very helpful. So, okay.
You're exactly right, Senator. And while Ms. Miette is getting that queued up, I can state from my own experience, being a survivor of suicide attempts when I was 17, when I told my friends what I was going to do, they just laughed and didn't know how to take me seriously. And so no one took me seriously, even though I told many people what I was going to do. And this program will train the teachers, the students, hopefully the parents, so that everyone takes these children seriously when they say that they're thinking about taking their own life. Because not all of us are as lucky as I was. Many of us don't get a second chance. Some of them become disfigured because they've used a weapon that didn't do the job completely, and they're still alive and they're quite disfigured. So I just can't say enough about the value of this program, and I appreciate that you recognize that as well. And I'm real anxious to see this new TV spot that she's going to show us.
He was in a number of different chat rooms telling kids all across the country that he was planning to kill himself. And unfortunately, nobody called us until it was too late, until he had died.
The last time I talked to him, I guess it was just a couple of hours before she died, she just kept talking and saying that she was really tired. I'm just so tired. And she said she was too tired to go downstairs and get something to eat. And
he went to her death. The sister went home from college for Thanksgiving vacation, and as she was getting ready to leave, she asked if she could borrow his favorite tie and jacket. And we all knew not to loan Sarah anything. You'd never give it back. If you did, you might not recognize it. He said yes, and then he gave it to her. My husband and I looked at each other like, oh, wow, they're not fighting anymore. Hooray. We didn't recognize that getting things away is a sign of impending suicide.
The story doesn't have to have a tragic ending. When parents, family members, and friends know the symptoms of depression and the warning signs of suicide, they can take action.
My son Alec is 15. He suffers from depression.
May I ask if that's, what's the complete videotape then? How long is it altogether?
It's about 15 minutes.
And I had time today, but
no, I know that, but I
have some other presenters, yeah. Right. But I do want to state that the last person you saw on there, the gentleman is Ron Bloodworth, and he was the state's first youth suicide prevention coordinator. And was he not?
Mm-hmm.
And we have the second youth suicide prevention coordinator in the room. And if you would come forward so that we can have you properly introduced. I probably took this away from you, but I couldn't wait to talk about how excited I am about these folks and what service they provide to this state. If you could just state your name and introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Senator Walker. My name is Donna Noonan, and I'm youth suicide prevention coordinator for Oregon.
And you do a tremendous job, and your predecessor did an awesome job as well, and I know that you are just continuing to do the work that we need to be done in this area, and it's a lot. And my colleagues, the Garrett Lee Smith bill has done a great deal to alert America and Congress and community leaders to this problem as well. And Oregon, as usual, has always been on the cutting edge of developing ideas and this program and what we offer in the data collection system. I did not know about that. So that's great.
Thank you, Chair Walker.
Thank you.
May I proceed?
Sure. We've got just a couple more minutes, and then we'll bring our other presenters up.
One of the things that SAFE Team does is it teaches students why some secrets are just too serious to keep. And so in SAFE Team implementation, we have 23 schools and 16 school districts involved in the implementation of SAFE Team across the state. And I'll give Lane County as an example. It's one of the best examples in the state. They have a 30-member countywide team that works on SAFE Team. In 03-04, they piloted this in three schools. The plan is in 04-05, they're adding schools, nine more schools. 05-06, seven more, and 06-07, there'll be up to eight more schools, and all the schools will be involved in Lane County at that point. Jill Hollingsworth is the coordinator of SAFE Teen in Lane County, and she sent along a copy of a report that is included in your handout. Some of the outcomes, the evaluation from the Lane County projects, 80% of students report they were more likely to tell an adult, and 80% of staff reported they were more prepared to identify and help a student exhibited signs of depression and or suicidality. And finally, in your packet you have a number of things. One sheet that tells how to get SAFE Teen in your school, and you'll need our help, but that's a starter. There's a SAFE Teen Train the Trainer brochure. And there are two brochures that were developed by Dr. Kirk Wolf, who is a child psychiatrist here in Oregon. And there's a large partnership. You'll see emblems of all the agencies and organizations that were involved in publishing this. One is called How Parents Can Look, Listen, and Help. And the other is What Every Teacher Should Know About Preventing Suicide. In addition, you've got the state plan that we're talking about updating, healthy teen survey data, attempt data that no other state has, death data. You've got Donna, our prevention coordinator, a state agency team for the prevention of suicide, intervention skills trainers that do ASSIST and QPR training. ASSIST stands for Applied Suicide Intervention Skills Training, and QPR stands for Question, Persuade, Respond. American Foundation for Suicide Prevention members, there's a board of about 20 people that meet monthly and work on issues of suicide prevention. They produced this film, and they were in this film that you just saw. They're also involved in producing the National American Foundation for Suicide Prevention's media project, and kids from Oregon participated in filming that. The Oregon Partnership is also a great partner, and there are lots and lots of local projects, too many to name. I gave you a map that shows all the counties and all the different activities that we know of involved in each county so that you can have an idea of what it's like across the state. Implementation of strategies is fairly uneven. A lot of implementation depends on having a champion, somebody that really wants to run with the ball, particularly when you don't have a lot of resources. In our state, we have lots of champions, and that map that illustrates that. There is a Youth Suicide Prevention Network. It's a listserv through the Oregon State Library, and you can sign up for that and see all the traffic that comes down on that. And we have lots of prevention brochures. We have an 800 number for suicide and local county crisis numbers that kids can use. And finally, you can find us in our website on that slide. And that's the end of my presentation. I want to thank you very much for all the time.
Thank you very much. Does this committee have any questions?
I'd like to see the tape. I'd like to have a copy of it at least tomorrow so I can watch the rest of it.
Chair Walker, Senator Morissette will make them available to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate you coming today. And our next set of presenters will do all three at the same time. We have three gentlemen in the back, and colleagues, I think their presentation might take a little bit more than 15 minutes, so if you could stay just a little bit, that would be great. Tom Eversall, Public Health Administrator for Benton County, Mitch Anderson, with the director, he's the director of Community Mental Health Center in Benton County, and Michael Cunningham with Willamette ESD. Did I catch all of you? That's fine. You can come on up, though. We can get you all three up here. Okay. And if you just want to start from left to right there and state your name.
Certainly. Good afternoon, Senator Walker and committee members. My name is Tom Eversall. I'm Health Administrator at Benton County Public Health Department.
Chair Walker and members of the committee, I'm Mitch Anderson. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Health Department in Benton County, more commonly referred to as the Mental Health Director because I'm in charge of the mental health programs.
And Chair Walker and the committee, I'm Michael Cunningham. I'm with the Mid-Valley Partnership for Safe Schools and Healthy Students, which is a multi-agency federal grant program that operates in Marion and Polk County, and I'm employed by the Willamette ESD.
Great, thank you. Okay, Mr. Eversall, why don't you start with your presentation for us?
Certainly, thank you. I'd like to just say a few words about our health department and how important I think it is that public health, mental health, and education work hand in hand, and certainly from our county experience, that's a good thing in both helping students be ready to succeed in schools, but also in offering population-wide interventions and services, as well as individual clinical care and support services for students as identified at risk. In public health, whether that's through situations about pertussis or flu. We're working very closely with schools or environmental health issues, drinking water, those sorts of things. But also in mental health, both in population-wide interventions around classes in behavior, bullying, early development, those sorts of things. We work very closely with our schools. I'm very appreciative of that relationship. We offer clinical services one-on-one at the health department because we're a combined public health and mental health agency. And also population-wise, again, we work with schools on public health issues like sexually transmitted diseases, reproductive health, substance abuse and prevention. And in our combined situation, we're very fortunate in that we can work together to approach population-wide public health issues and mental health issues through our health promotion and education team. We have transferable skills among that set of folks. So whether it's a public health issue or a mental health issue or other, we can work with the school to address those as those issues might be assigned to the teams. We work very closely with our ASSIST program, which is a public health model for mental health delivery in which we work with identified families and individuals. And I'm going to, so I don't take up a lot of time, turn it over to Mitch, who can talk more specifically about the mental health interventions.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, we've worked really hard in Benton County to create a program to work with youth and intervene early for mental health conditions. And as a key component of that, we felt like the program needed to be very closely tied with education because that's where our children are. A number of years ago, the county passed a health and safety levy which funded our ASSIST team that Mr. Ebersole talked about. That team is a group of mental health professionals, again, funded off of our local county funds, whose job it is to respond to schools who have concerns about children. And what we wanted to do is build a team that went beyond the typical kind of crisis response, that we really weren't going to just respond to behavioral problems, but we also wanted to have a team that could respond when a teacher had a concern about a child. So the quiet child in the corner who may not be acting up and creating all sorts of problems, but there was a concern about what was going on. And what we've allowed with this team is they're freed up around the county. They take calls. They go out to the school. They will engage with the youth. And their second piece of their engagement is with the family. And they work under a strengths-based model where the goal is really not to start the intervention saying, what's wrong with this kid and what do we need to do? But they really engage the family. They'll go out, meet with the family in their home, and talk about how things are going. Talk about the youth's strengths, talk about concerns that may have come up. And they work with the family for up to 30 days, really helping build a plan to help the family feel better about what's going on with the youth, to build upon strengths, things like that. Engage them, and then help them get connected to the services that the family and the assist worker identify that might help that child. We found the intervention very, very successful in that the family members feel like they're not on the defensive. It's no more that call from the school about, you know, Johnny's in trouble, and immediately as a parent you're backpedaling going, wait a minute, you know, this is my child you're talking about. So really, this being a friendly, there's a concern, let's sit down and talk about what's going on and what the county may be able to offer you in terms of services that could help.
Mr. Anderson, could you stop just for a second?
Mm-hmm.
How many members of your assist team do you send out to a family?
Typically one will go out at a time, but it may be two. Depends upon the situation.
Okay.
The team itself is four staff.
Okay.
And we have four different school districts in Benton County, and they respond to all of them. Again, as they build a plan, and one of the areas that certainly this team would address would be youth suicide. And our hope is again, this is more of a preventative intervention, that very early signs of something's not right get caught, and the focus is really on building the family's strengths to help their child and monitor for what's going on. What's been real interesting over the 5 years of this ASSIST program is that The constituency behind it has steadily grown. The schools have been before our local county board of commissioners testifying that this is one of the most valuable programs for the schools that they have. We have parents who just say wonderful things about how this program has helped them, and we'll continue this in the future. The school and the educational services district are contributing funds through some of the funding they get from Medicaid administrative match to help support this team. So it's really becoming a partnership with the health department taking the lead to support this kind of proactive intervention. Now, we'll be expanding further as we work on the youth suicide pilot project, and our assist team is configured to do this kind of outreach. And so this connecting youth project that was spoken about earlier, we'll have a team member that participates on that, and the goal will be that another of assist's customers will become the emergency room. And so when the emergency room has a youth present there who has made an attempt, that information will get passed to our assist team, and we will do an intervention with that family. Again, it will be an outreach, not so much somebody needs treatment here, but this was a concerning event. We want to make sure your family knows about resources. What we're wanting to do is really work to stop those repeat events. And so,
and that's a program that's just now starting?
Yes, that's one of the pilot projects that will just start. And so we're real excited about that. It fits with this model that we've already created and offers one more avenue to engage a family in making sure that they have the education, the tools, the resources to really help support their family and the youth with the difficulties.
Sure. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, okay. It's a paranoia I have having to do with HIPAA, and so when somebody presents in the hospital with an incident, how can you move that information where it needs to go?
We certainly don't skip the rules around that. What there will be is the emergency room staff will discuss the issue with the family. And
you have to go through the family for dissemination.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Certainly don't want to. I think it's a very fair question.
We're also paranoid here because we really don't know if the other shoe hasn't fallen on that stuff yet. So.
Yes. So I think for us, we thought this would be a really good example of, again, this partnership between the county, both public and mental health, because Mr. Everall-Saul was saying, the assist program, it's really not a mental health treatment program per se. The team will refer children and families it works with to treatment programs, either ours or some of our other providers in the community, but our goal is really more of a neutral entity to work with the family and figure out what do you need, how can we help you. And we just see a huge amount of success in terms of that engagement of the family where there's not fingers being pointed, and then they build a plan where the family really has a big part in making that plan. The latest goal of that team this year was that as they build a team for each youth and family, that 50% of the people on the team are family members or friends. And so the teams are not even necessarily all professionals. They want it to be real family friendly and help the family figure out how they can use their own resources and supports to support them. So anyway, I think I'll stop there.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
That's good. So, I mean, we've in helping families with social services, we've gone to wraparound models. This sounds very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I had a question, Mr. Anderson. When Benton County floated the bond measure, was this just the sole purpose for the bond measure, or was that a piece of a larger funding package?
It was a health and safety levy that supported some law enforcement services, juvenile department services, and then these health programs.
Okay, great. And then from your testimony, the ESDs have contributed with funding as well. So that's a great segue into Mr. Cunningham, who's with the Willamette ESD. Does that cover Benton County?
No.
Okay.
The Willamette ESD provides services in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill.
Oh, Yamhill. Just a little bit to the north then. Okay, great. Well, thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Cunningham, if you want to state your name again.
You bet. I'm Michael Cunningham.
It'll warm up.
Oh, okay. I'm Michael Cunningham. I'm with the Willamette Education Service District. I'm a coordinator in a Safe Schools Healthy Students grant program. And I have some materials I can speak to from those. And here it is. This is kind of a low-tech presentation.
We like low-tech.
But I guess I'd like to talk a little bit about the magnitude of the problem in Marion and Polk County. In a five-year period between 1999 and 2003, 29 youth between the ages of 10 and 24 took their lives, and of those, six were youth under the age of 18. And if we look at ER data for 2003, 67 Marion County youth and 6 Polk County minors, these are now minors under 18, attempted suicide. And as Lisa Mitt had noted, these are somewhat underreported data. The number of attempts is probably much larger than that. These are just ones that required an emergency room visit and that were actually reported by the hospital. Probably more telling is the fact that in the last school year, the 2003 to 2004 school year, 331 Marion County youth were assessed at school for potential suicide risk as a result of a school-based referral, and 194 Marion County youth were assessed in a psychiatric crisis center on the basis of a family or self-referral. So schools really are quite a referral source if you look at the numbers. In our area, we have a very good partnership between the Salem-Keizer School District and the Willamette Education Service District and the health departments, both in Marion and Polk County. And as a task force a few years ago, we developed a map of a protocol that we would follow. And I realize that it's impossible to read from the screen, but just to get a little sense of the blue star, some sort of suicidal gesture or attempt or ideation is that someone becomes aware of it, either a peer, a student's peer, or a teacher, and the event funnels its way to a counselor or an administrator, who then, of course, if things are dire, would call 911, but in most instances would just collect some information and find out if the concerns are specious or real, and if they seem real, would then do a formal screening, involve the parent, and then develop a support plan for the student. And in instances where the risk seemed clear, it was more than a low risk, to refer on to a mental health specialist who would come to the school and actually do a suicide risk assessment and involve the school and family in a planning process. So I think that's been a good approach for us. We knew that we had to train our screeners, these counselors, as you can see, they're in key roles in our schools. And so we provided I've just given you the index for this, but there's a reference for how to get this particular screener's handbook. We tried to make it short and sweet and give them just a few pages where they could understand the process and their role within it, and also that we could give them information that they could then in turn share with their staff in terms of warning signs and how the process worked and when to refer. We also, as a Mid-Valley partnership, became very involved in the last year in a suicide prevention campaign, and it was targeted to all of our middle schools and high schools in Marion and Polk County, and involved wallet cards that contained more than just phone numbers. They contained clear advice for what friends can do when they're dealing with other friends who are in trouble. And we also developed a brochure with that addresses what school staff members can do and what parents can do, and we distributed those in the schools so that they could use those with parents. And then these posters, which we then had student leadership groups determine where in schools they wanted to place them. And many of them were placed, I think, comically but understandably, in bathrooms.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting you raised that issue, because I've been working on suicide prevention issues for a number of years, and that was one of the locations that we said was the best place. Particularly for young girls and women who are victims of sexual abuse and domestic violence, because It's a very private place. Mm-hmm. They're sitting down. They're a captive audience, and you're exactly right.
Yes, Senator Walker, and you're also usually a little bored during that time. Well, I'm speaking from personal experience. I also wanted to share with you, I thought, to get a sense of how this model is actually working, it's fine to talk about what we sort of structured as a system, and today's been very instructive for me to hear from my colleagues in Benton County and also from Lisa Miette, because I've got some new ideas as a result of being here today. But I want to share with you some data from the Salem-Keizer School District. As you know, it's the largest school district in our area, 37,000 students out of compared to the 24,000 students we have in rural Marion and Polk. And you can see that they started collecting data just this last year on how many actual screenings counselors were doing and when those screenings led to a referral for a mental health specialist to come out and do the suicide risk assessment, and how many follow-up plans involve school responsibilities as part of the plan. And you can see that last year in Salem-Keizer, their counselors screened 42 middle schoolers and 98 high school students. 18 of the middle schoolers and 64 of the high school students were referred on for a suicide risk assessment. And that doesn't strike me as odd. It would occur to me that most high school referrals, the likelihood of seriousness would increase compared to middle school referrals. I think in middle schools is such a emotionally volatile, a labile age that it often kids could say, I just can't imagine, you know, I just want to die. I can't imagine living another day, and then a couple of hours later be laughing with their friends. It's quite possible. So I think many of those screens probably ruled out cases that where you just had a student with a transitory feeling versus those when you collected information you had some real concern and referred on. And then of the students that were referred on to, you can see in pretty much all of the cases, follow-up support and safety plans were created, and schools had some real role in terms of mentoring, check-ins, some confidential information to staff that needed to know that this was a kid that needed a little propping up, needed an extra connection. And so I think our system seems to be working, although as I heard about Safe Teen, I thought that they're doing something in a systematic way that layers on this quite nicely, mm-hmm. So I want to look into that.
Great.
Yeah.
Senator Cruz.
I'd be interested in seeing the screen that's used for the assessment, or what the questions that are asked, your pamphlet has risk factors, but that's kind of a 50,000-foot view, and simply when we were doing Healthy Start way back when, we were looking at different screening tools and which would be best and all that, so it'd be interesting to see, you know, if there's any sort of uniformity in what we're using as a screen and what we think is most effective in for that tool, so...
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, I'd be very happy to supply the committee with a copy of the full screening manual. It's only 13 or 14 pages long. It's got a lot of good information in addition to the one-page screen that people are using.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yes, Senator Morissette.
Do you think that the schools in your district could provide this service for themselves, that you're doing your ESD, right?
Yes.
Yes. Is this an essential service that you provide?
Chair Walker, Senator Morissette, I believe it is an essential service. I believe that our school districts are quite varied in terms of their size. We have districts in Fall City and St. Paul that are under 200 students that don't have a school counselor, and then we have districts all the way up until Salem-Keizer. And I think it would be there's a certain economy of scale in providing that service on a regional basis. So counselors are certainly part of the system, and we provide training for those counselors on how to screen. But especially with schools that don't have counselors, we really need to support them more with the mental health specialists that we have. through our...
We may invite you back for another hearing. Thank you for saying that.
Well, and Senator Moore said I was going to ask that question, too. So I'm glad, because I'm sensitive to your concerns about... We introduced a committee bill today to consolidate ESDs, and it's a sensitive subject in this committee and in this building, and it's a bill for plenty of discussion, and so you are very... It's apropos that you are here today discussing the service that you provide as an ESD, so I appreciate that. And I actually appreciate all of you gentlemen coming today and sharing with us the tremendous things that you do for our children. And I wish you well in all your endeavors. And I think I'm going to need to close the committee because it's 10 after 5 and our committee has been here in a long day. And you have one more comment. Senator Moore said.
To the chair. You put on a great meeting. You had a great group of people here. It was very educational.
Absolutely.
Very enjoyable, and you did a good job.
And thank you. And Senator Starr, you have a question?
I see that the slide doesn't add up. 18 and 64 is not 86. And you've got four more referrals in there.
Chair Walker, Senator Starr, I can easily address that. Sometimes you'll make a plan even after a screening. You don't necessarily make a plan only when you've gone for the suicide risk assessment. Sometimes you might decide as a school counselor and in consultation with other another trained screener, you may decide that, no, this isn't a case that really needs to go to a mental health specialist, a specialist for an assessment. But yet there are concerns here that we do need to address in a support plan, which is why the numbers wouldn't necessarily equal.
Thank you. And I hope that we all have learned something from one another and can share in our resources as we help keep our children alive so they can lead productive lives. Thank you, committee. Thank you, everyone. We're adjourned.